Hello, and thank you for joining this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation. My name is Michele Mosca, and I'm an associate faculty member here at Perimeter Institute and deputy director of the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo. Welcome to those of you joining us here at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and also to those of you joining us online from around the world. This event is sponsored by Burgundy Asset Management. I would like to offer them a warm thanks for their support of this special discussion you're about to enjoy. Thank you very much. Before we begin the lecture, I'll ask those of you in the theater to please turn off your Blackberries and phones. And those of you at home, you can keep your Blackberries and phones on, but please share this presentation with friends by pointing them to q2cfestival.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at q2cfestival. Today's discussion will be moderated by Andrew Revkin. Mr. Revkin has been reporting on the environment for the New York Times since 1995. In 2003, he became the first Times reporter to file stories and photos from the sea ice around the North Pole. He is the author of several books and writes a blog called Dot Earth about efforts to balance human affairs with the planet's limits. So he is the ideal person to lead this discussion on our planet's resources and the outlook for the next 50 years. Please join me in welcoming our host, Andrew Revkin.
It's great to be here, and I'm going to just introduce Václav Šmíl very quickly so we can just jump right into the conversation. It's a conversation I've been wanting to have face-to-face for a long time. He's a distinguished professor in the Environment Department at the University of Manitoba, a little west of here. And he's on my go-to list on so many questions. Technological innovation, energy, population, disasters, all the things I cover for the New York Times and on our website. I'm constantly reaching out to him for some advice. He's one of these rare minds that, there's another guy who, Murray Gell-Mann, who talks about what he calls the importance of taking a crude look at the whole. His acronym is CLAW, C-L-A-W. And Dr. Šmíl takes a detailed look at the whole as much as possible in order to get a handle on trajectories that are impossible to consider if you're just looking at physics, just looking at biology, just looking at human society. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Šmíl up here, and we're going to go sit down and have a discussion. And I'm a reporter, so I always come with pad and pen in hand. At the North Pole, though, you can't use a pen. The ink freezes. So I learned you bring a pencil to the North Pole. And batteries on anything electronic go bad. So it really is a fun place to go to get away from technology. But here we are. We're at this juncture that looks pretty special. Here, as a reporter, I look at where we are in history. And just 130, 150 years ago, there were only 1 billion people on the whole planet, grandparents, young people. Of course, the grandparents were only 40 years old, if that. Now there are 1 billion teenagers on planet Earth. And we're heading toward 9 billion, more or less. The reason we're asking the question, 9 billion people plus one planet equals what, is it's hard to get around that number, plus or minus some error bar. But so from 1 billion to 9 billion in a century and a half, and it doesn't look very sustainable when you see that curve. And you've been writing a lot lately about this question of that the next two generations worth of time. So first of all, is this a special time? Is this, if you look at the history of our species, or are we just being chronocentric? There's a guy at Cornell who says every generation thinks that their time is special. Is this a unique juncture for our species?
Yeah. Well, I think every civilization is chronocentric. There is nothing new about this. And it's not special at all in terms of people feeling privileged or extremely threatened or saying, never before. But certainly as far as this basic number goes, it is, right? Because if you think that we pass, billion, we don't know exactly, but let's say 1810, something like that, and 1.6 billion, 1900, and now we are pushing 7. We may never get to 9. That's a good news, okay? This is one fascinating news. news that about forecasts. I never forecast because forecasts always are wrong. This one particularly, many people forecast long-term population, but United Nations has been doing it professionally for decades now. Every successive long-term forecast of United Nations has been lowered and lowered and lowered again. If you'd be in this room 40 years ago, you'd be talking about 12 billion people. Right? 20 years ago, we were talking about 10 billion people. Right? Now there is a very high probability, something like 70-80%, will never make it to 9 billion. Right? So we may stop at 8.2, 8.5, and that makes a big difference if it's 8 or 9, especially because, to answer more directly your question, it all depends what we want to do. We were just talking a while ago with Andy about these things. If Chinese, and Chinese want it, unlike Japanese. Chinese want to be like Americans, plus maybe 20% on top of it. So of course it's impossible, right? If you have Chinese and Indian wanting to do America, well, then you don't need 8 billion. Then you need just 1.3 billion Chinese and 1 billion Indians, and they cannot be like 300 million Americans. On the other hand, you know, if people will try to do, if only the whole Western world would do the Japanese shtick, well, this would be very different because Japanese are consuming only half as much energy per capita as the Canadians and Americans are, right? And they are consuming, well, consumption is the wrong thing. We have now, I tell you this figure, this is absolutely astonishing. In this continent, we have now 3,700 kilocalories of food available per day per capita, including babies and grannies. And we eat, of course, only about 2,000, really. Yeah. Japan is about 2,800 available, and they eat about 2,000. So they waste everything less. They waste less food, less energy. So if the world would want to live like Japan, well, it's still dicey, but kind of doable. But if the world want to replicate the two biggest wasters in the world, that is US and Canada, there is no hope for anybody.
Now, I talked to this, when I'm out asking questions of people about this, where we're headed, there seem to be two durable camps. There's the camp that says we are a Wile E. Coyote, the American cartoon series where a roadrunner used to run around and this coyote would chase him, and he would end up way out over the edge of a cliff and not realize it. So there's the cliff edge camp that says we're way out over the edge of the cliff. We've overshot, and we just don't know it yet. We're about to hit a brick wall, and we just don't know it yet. And then there's the enduring technical optimists who say innovation and wealth have always gotten us through. Every time we've thought we've hit a limit, we've moved to something new. In fact, we're always redefining what is a resource. I'll give you one example. You know, 400 years ago, coal was just a black rock. Then it became the underpinning of our economies. So there'll be some new thing, so no worries, we can just party on, and the whole world can live like Americans. Is there anyone right?
Yes, both are right, and this is the funniest thing about this. You know, this is very difficult because people want to have it not necessarily clear-cut, but not so messy as this, and this is very messy. Both are true. In any way, we are hanging out there already at Coyote, just totally hanging out there, right? Uh-huh. But in other ways, we have so many options ahead of us, talking about new resources. How many people, it's just the thing like this KGB interrogation, these lights in my eyes, so I can't see your faces, but how many people in this room know what a Marcellus shale is?
The Marcellus shale.
How many people in this room know what Marcellus shale is? Maybe two hands or something like that, really, right? How many people know what a Barnett shale is?
Barnett shale.
The same people, of course, who know Marcellus, naturally, right? See, so maybe like three people out of this whole crowd, right? Well, you know, this is why you will be paying a lot less for your natural gas this winter, because this shale was always there, but shale is shale. Shale is pretty hard and tough. You wouldn't think it's full of gas, yet it is. But if you just drill a hole through it like that, well, you know, very little will come out, just very. But if you get something which is called horizontal drilling, which we have been doing now for about two decades, better and faster and cheaper, you just can follow that seam, and horizontal drilling is the wrong term. Horizontal drilling would be you sink and then you go like that. No, we can go like this, basically. We can drill each other. So you follow that shale seam and you fracture it, you loosen it, and that gas just starts oozing out of it. US has many formations of these gas-bearing shales, and they are in China, and they are in India, and they are in, the whole world is floating on many, many of these shales, so to speak. This is why the gas prices have been halved or 60% down or whatever, and while we continue, and some of these shales are conveniently located, you know, Barnett, Texas, Marcellus Shale, few kilometers away from New York, literally in Pennsylvania. Right. So this is the future. So this is, we keep redefining resources all the time. So you look at, you know, you look at the let's say reserve production ratio, saying how much natural gas we have at the current rate of production, and you look at these things 10 years ago. Oh, it's becoming very dicey. And then you just simply redefine that these shales, which have been always there, as a major natural gas resource.
Right.
And it's not dicey at all. A single one of these formations is good enough to supply US for the next 20 years. And we have a bunch of these formations in the US.
So now you're suddenly sounding like one of those optimists. So.
Exactly.
So this is, where's the wall, though?
This is the example of that thing, you know, how we always redefine how we have more. On the other end, we have news like, you know, GM is unloading Hummer onto whom? Onto Chinese. So Chinese will be making Hummers. Now, if a similar percentage of Chinese would want to buy Hummers as a similar percentage of Americans, we have something like 30 million people driving Hummers in China, right? Well, you know, Hummer, last time I checked in these medieval units, you know, we do it in civilized world and liters per 100 kilometers, but in this continent it's MPG. Well, Hummer is like something like 15 MPG really, right? You know, the car I drive is close to 50 MPG, right? So there again, you are hanging far off the cliff if China is buying Hummer, right? And they are not buying it with the intent of keeping a logo. They are buying it with the intent of making it really. There are many examples very sort of in between. Let me give you some good ones. First, we have to eat before Hummers or before anything, before flying to Mars and, you know, checking for whatever. We have to eat first. So you have to apply macronutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus. Nitrogen is relatively easy because as long as we have some energy, we can take the nitrogen out of the air and combine it with hydrogen from natural gas, Haber-Bosch synthesis, and we can make lots of ammonia and go home. It's just energy costly. Phosphate is different. We have to dig it. And we are not exactly running out, but we are running out of cheap, easily accessible, and very clean phosphate. There is lots of phosphate out there, which is not so easily accessible, and which is dirty, which is lots of other things which we don't want to have it, to dump it on the... So there is now a latest worry, because we have to worry all the time, right? Gas prices were rising. We will all starve because the energy costs will be high, and nitrogen fertilizer will go through the roof. Now the gas prices are falling, so nitrogen is okay, right? Now it's the phosphates we have to fear. So there have been several meetings in past year about how we are running out of phosphates, right?
Right.
Not speaking about the fact that there are undersea mountains full of phosphate. So eventually we'll go there, right? So we'll redefine the resource again. But if we want to eat, and again, you see, you have to redefine it back and forth again. If all of us, planet-wide, want to eat the North American diet, 100 kilo of meat per year per capita, big man's body weight in meat, and I mean boneless meat, right? In bone, it's like 100.
That gets the point across.
So if you,
that's a lot.
If you multiply by 7 billion people, right? Different story, right? If you do it Japanese way, 40 kilo of meat per year per capita, well, you know, you can extend it a little bit more, so you can bring that coyote somewhat back. So it depends what we want to do, really. So it's just, these things are so yes and no and both, because it critically depends which way we will turn.
So we can't just sort of invent our way out of this.
No, there is simply no way. There is this group, this true total techno-optimist, this innovation will get us out of anything, really. Mm-hmm. That's utterly wrong. On the other end, to say that we are hemmed and bound by resources which are so terribly limited, there is no hope for us, that's wrong as well, really, right? It still depends. The day is not so late. It still depends on what we are going to do. 100 kilo of meat and Hummers, okay? Right. Or 40 kilo of meat and Hondas, right? We still can do these things, right?
I've got to write that down. See, there you go. If I were able to Twitter right now,
and it's alliterative, Hondas and Hummers, right?
Yeah, no, I like that very much. Well, you read a lot of literature too.
Yeah,
and
I do.
This gets at another point that's come up increasingly for me, which is that values enter into this journey between now and the middle of the century beyond. It isn't just about technology.
Of course.
I did a piece on the blog recently where I mused, what if we had the perfect energy source? Suppose we had infinite solar photovoltaics became as cheap as paint. So we solved that problem. You could desalinate the ocean, you could manufacture food increasingly if you found the phosphates. And we could have a carrying capacity of, I don't know, tens of billions of people. Now does that mean, it implies that we haven't solved the problem. And this gets to human nature. How much of the problem of dealing with this transition is sort of in our heads, in the sense that it's part of how we're constituted?
I shouldn't say all, that would be facetious, but you know, bulk of it is. I give you an example. Always, you know, the personal experience is always best. So I know a great deal about the United States, used to live there, and I, at one point in my life, I spent like 70-80% working on China in late 70s and 80s. And I know Japan pretty well. I go there all the time. I live there again this spring. you see these differences. Japanese do not want to be Americans. They are, this is an old civilization which always lived with great limits. The islands are not that small, they say small islands, not that small, but they are poor in the sense that 85% are mountains. Not just kind of, you know, this mountains, but pretty steep mountains. So you always had a limited amount of arable land. So you had all these ancient taboos against eating meat. So people say, oh, this is Buddhist or Shinto. No, in fact, it's just the recognition of the reality that if 15% of my land is flat and I still have to put tens of millions of people there, kind of houses and transportation, I will not have that many fields, so I have to devote these fields to food crops. I cannot grow feed for pigs or for cows or whatever. Right? So Japanese have been always living with the limits, and they had ores, you know. You know, in 18th, 17th century, they had good production of copper and gold and silver. You know, they major, but they never had any big energy sources. You know, coal, very little, not good quality. Then came hydro energy in 19th century, but not that much. So they were had to always live within their means, really. And to this very day, they do. They still have very high saving rates. And their expectations are different. Their expectations are not having, you know, second house somewhere, you know, 1,000 kilometers away, you know, whatever. So, unlike Chinese, which used to be this grand civilization running the show, like Chungguo, the center of the world, and they are coming back now. They feel basically that what happened in past couple hundred years, because don't forget, until about 1780, 1820, they were the number one economy in the world. They were the largest economy, and many ways, most advanced economy, right? A typical Chinese peasant in good years, non-famine years, was living as well in 1780 as a typical French peasant, not anniversary, right? And then the misfortunes came, right? Then China fell on these hard times, you know? So past 200 years have been awful, but now they feel not only vindicated, now they feel they are fully on the horse and galloping. Now they feel is what? Every marginal dollar America wants, like, you know, yesterday, day before yesterday, America is granting Pakistan another $7.5 billion. Well, no, this money comes directly from Chinese Communist Politburo, right? Because America has no additional $7.5 billion. It has to borrow it from China now, right? Or print it, right? You know, that's a choice, right? So Chinese feel now they are coming back. And they are coming back not like Japanese, kind of, you know, well, we'll keep it. No, they are coming back in grand style. They want to outdo the United States, and they are working full tilt at it. I remember when I used to go there in early 80s, and I was telling them, build fast trains, what we call in Japan, Shinkansen, right? New trunk line. Build Shinkansen everywhere, right? They couldn't care less. They are building now, right now. But what they built in 80s and 90s and early 2000s, they are building an interstate system which will put the US interstate system to shame.
For cars.
Six-lane highways for cars everywhere, right? Because they want to outdo America, really. And so India. It's all in your head. It's all in your head.
And
right?
Then there's India, yeah. Which will...
And then there is India, which, of course, eventually wants to outdo China, because Indians, Chinese think they are superior to us because they invented everything when we were sort of, you know, cavemen. But Indians think they are superior to Chinese because they come with this early astronomy and mathematics and Vedas and everything, you know. So they think they should be the rightful masters of the universe, really. Right? And so they are trying to catch up, and especially now with all this electronic stuff, right? There is no Bangalore in China. So
you think, you're right? Tipping me back toward the downside, the Wile E. Coyote crowd here.
Yeah, of course. You know, yeah.
Where does the needle end up here, though? Or is it just, this is a discouraging picture.
It is a discouraging picture because, and it's even more discouraging because we encourage it, you know. Yeah. We are happy, you know, we are happy to sell Hummer to Chinese, right? Yeah. We are happy to create Bangalore, really,
yeah.
Right?
You know,
so
oh, for sure.
we are raising these expectations. We are saying, you know, here it is, you could be like us, really, right? But when they'll be like us, well, look, the calculation is simple. US 310 whatever, 10 million, including some, we don't know how many illegals, plus minus 10 million. So 310 US, Canada close to 35, right? So 350, yeah. Say roughly, right? Yeah. 350 million out of 7 billion, right? Say 5%, roughly speaking, right? Yeah. And we consume 28% of everything on this planet, right? Or 25 or 30, yeah. Depending how you define it, right? So let's go for 25, right? 5% consume 25, right? If the rest of the world will do the same trick, what do we do? Five planets, right? Five more planets. This is a very simple calculation. There is no, yeah. There is no rocket science involved in this.
So, and we only have one, as far yeah. As we know.
So that's just the thing, right? So as simple as that. So people don't realize the depths, and Canadians especially are peculiar. Everybody knows that Americans are rapacious and, you know, aggressive, but Canadians are nice and neat and soft and saving the world, you know. We per capita produce more everything than Americans, what is bad, you know. We got more forests in BC than Brazil does, right? You know, we pollute, per capita, we pollute and screw the planet more than any American does, really, right? As simple as that, right?
I mean, now I'm feeling better. No, just kidding. Yeah.
But somehow we have this image, you know, we have this soft image abroad, you know, Canadians are these do-gooders, Americans are these, you know, rapacious, you know. It's good PR, yeah. Good PR.
So
right?
where are the, what you've written a lot. In fact, your most recent book that I have in my bag back there is on these catastrophes or emergencies that are coming or could come. There's a probability kind of thing here. Climate has been one that's been talked about so much lately. And the energy use and emissions that are reflected by what could happen with China and India, one would think, I mean, if you accept the basics of these gases trap heat, and if we double or triple the amount in the atmosphere, we're in for a lot of climate change. Is that the biggest pinch point, or are there other things that would come up before that?
We don't know. And you see, this is just a thing which bugs me immensely that and I get lots of bad press for that because I am unwilling to commit myself on saying like 2040 extra degrees Celsius, so much warms, planet goes down. This global warming is very complex and we don't know. You know very well what happened in past 10 years, right? Basically no global warming in past 10 years, right? And people say, oh, we anticipated that. I say, who did? Did somebody publish a paper? You know, did Jim Hansen in 1988, his famous speech to Congress, saying global warming is here, did he say, oh, global warming is here, but it will basically stop for 10 years, right? Nobody said that. It's a very complex thing. Of course, this doesn't mean at all that it will not, you know, jump back again and, you know, with twice as force 5 or 10 years from now. But I'm just giving you the example of last 10 years, right? As there is, you know, it is very complex.
This just said something I wanted to actually, I don't mean to interrupt, but there's this idea that humans, again, we're so focused on the here and now, which is, of course, about the that kind of wiggle in a curve. And even if the curve is going up, 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 this is something I've characterized on the blog as a slow drip problem. And you have your own sense of that being one category of problem that you feel is a pretty big deal. And we're always distracted, though, by what's happening now.
Let me just think. So I don't know if this... If you have this orthodox view, right, it's what I call the IPCC view, right? So basically, and it's been getting actually worse than better. There were periods, you know, when some of these IPCC reports, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, they keep coming, you know, that at one point kind of, you know, we said, okay, it's not so bad. It maybe will be just, you know, then a little bit worse, okay? That's like what's HIV, right? You know, we always felt that the 80s, it'll be better, worse. So IPCC is much the same thing. Now we are in the worst period, you know. Now people are publishing these papers saying, you know, it'll be much worse than we anticipated, right? But we've been there before. Maybe 5 years from now, they'll say, it'll be a little better than we anticipated. But the point is that this is unfolding slowly. This is not going to be with us in full force. Nobody claims it, even the Orthodox people in 2015, whatever, right? But in between, there are great many things coming in between. And this is why in this book I concluded absolutely solidly I stand behind it and, you know, being vindicated already, I say, you know, the pandemic is number one, right?
Pandemic.
Because we are overdue for a pandemic, right? When you look back, we have reasonably good record for about 200 years, and they come, you know, irregularly, but they do come eventually, right? And the real ones, we haven't had a real one. The last one which we had was nothing. It was an extra 2 million additional deaths globally. There was nothing, right? But we should eventually get, and we shall eventually get, a 1918-type pandemic, right? And if you just do your math from 1918 pandemic, when we had about 1.7 billion people, when you had about 60 million deaths, prorated to 7 billion people a number of deaths, right? We could see something on the order of, plus, much greater transmissivity. Jets are flying, you know, between the continents and, you know, so on. So you could end up with 100 million dead people in 6 or 8 months or a year, really, right? And this, so H1N1 very likely will not be it, really, right? But it may be a prelude to what's to come, and you see how people are panicked, telling you, you know, that if there'll be 10,000 people who need ventilators, well, our hospitals are only 500 ventilators, right, for 10,000 people, right? So imagine if it'll be 100 million people. So, you know, I'm not looking at whatever, how much temperature you'll have in 2050. I'm looking at a big pandemic which may come in 2015 or 2020. So, you know, this is really, this is the greatest risk we run.
What are the other things we're kind of missing?
The other thing, which is totally forgotten now, Cold War is over, you know, Russians kind of, oh, there are more troublesome under Putin, but still, you know, it's kind of, hey, there are thousands and thousands of warheads out there, right? Okay? And they are still there, right? So the chance of accidental nuclear war, chance of stealing these things, this is still big. There are thousands of unguarded, poorly guarded, or imperial warheads. What's happening in Pakistan today? Why do they assure us every day in the newspapers, Pakistani arsenal is safe, right? You know, well, is it really safe, right? In a nation where millions of people go to madrasas where they are taught, you know, just blow them up, the infidels. Is it really safe, right?
Is it?
Well, you know, I have no idea. I have no idea. So you see, these are these things, right? So between the accidental wars and the pandemics and then the things which kind of, you know, this general, how about all these things? I mean, this does happen every day that a country like U.S. spends additional $2 trillion in 6 months. Mm-hmm. Now, where that will end, really, right? How that shall be repaid? What it will do to the global economy? I think people haven't even started to appreciate the depths of the economic misery awaiting the Western world, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the real unemployment in the U.S. is about 17 or 18% now, the real unemployment, right? The official unemployment is whatever now. Yeah. But real unemployment, these are either the best statistical estimate we have. So real unemployment, 17%, okay? It's just, and the country is sinking into debt fast. It's just, the notions are incredible. Until 1985, the US was a net creditor nation, right? Now it's the biggest debtor nation in human history. And it's sinking at a rate of $2 trillion every 6 months. And now they are talking about what? A health scare, which according to the Speaker of the Senate will cost $2 trillion again,
for
right?
The health program.
For just health care alone. Yeah. So these people are now tossing trillions of dollars every few weeks. It cannot go on. So talking about the coyote, you know, forget about 2050 and deforestation or the hunger. Talk about the U.S. economy, totally hanging out there, really, just about to fall, really, right?
So what's an approach, if you're in a policy position, if you're President Obama or in the EU in leadership, what's a better approach to risk management than the one we're taking right now on these various issues? You know, if you're looking at the climate problem or you're looking at the nuclear problem, what gets us into the box of, there's a trait that I wrote on, actually a reader of my blog of .earth about a year and a half ago posted this phrase that I thought wonderfully encapsulated a big chunk of how we deal with stuff. And it's blah, 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 bang.
Right.
And that you could apply that to everything from terrorism to climate. What can we do to sort of do an end run around, again, this gets back to our own nature perhaps, that blah, 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 bang tendency on some of these issues?
As far as all these consumption, nuclear stuff is different, but as far as the consumption stuff is concerned, it's very simple. Do with less, but no politician has a gumption to walk out there. People don't even realize to what level we've begun over-consuming. It's just absolutely astonishing. You know, if you would spend some time with statistics, you know, people don't like statistics, and statistics are, you know, okay, you know, you have to know how to interpret, many of them are not, but still, you know, I mean, let's say France, a beautiful country, a powerful country, you know, all these nuclear reactors, you know, train on ground with us, it's a great nation. Well, you know, it's only recently great nation in terms of consuming stuff. In late 1950s, most of the French didn't have a bathroom. And that's a fact. Go to the French historical statistics, right? In early 1960s, we were consuming, not as a nation, because the structure of energy consumption was different, but personal consumption, less than half energy than we are consuming now. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, the personal stories are very simple.
And but the same statistics show that we were not less happy.
Of course, well, I'll get into it in a second.
Yeah, okay. When
we came to Canada from US in 72, everybody on that street had one little dinky car. When we left that street 17 years later, we were the only people with one car. Everybody had 2.5 cars, and one being like 3-ton SUV, right? Yeah. You know, people don't realize how this overconsumption of everything is very recent. It's a matter of last 40 years, and in North America, especially of last 20 years, right? And you start adding these things up, right? And it's just immense. So let's say if you take Japan, right? And if you take France, they are pretty much the same. In terms of energy, all energy sources per year per capita, it's about 170 gigajoules per year per capita, France and Japan. We are about 360, okay? So we are double than they are, right? But you look inside that figure, and you see that out of these 170 in France and Japan, a much bigger chunk goes into making things, because Japan still makes things. We don't make things. We just import everything from China now, right? So most of the energy in Western society, in North America, is just consuming it, Walmart, shopping centers, right? You know, government offices, right? Yeah. All the personal consumption, houses, cars, flying to Hawaii, right? Gambling to Las Vegas and whatever, really, right? You know, so, you know, we could live very nice, you know, we had a very nice standard of living. We could live affluent lifestyles with half as much energy because, as I say, you know, are people so unhappy in Kyoto or Lyon? Is it such a terrible punishment to live in Bordeaux or to live in whatever, you know, in Kyushu? I mean, you know, so, yeah. And as you pointed, this is a new science now, of course, the science of happiness, science of quality of life. So we have a good deal. Again, it's, you know, it depends. Loaded question, whatever. But still, we know, like with statistics, we know well enough to say this, really, right? And we have in U.S. actually, because of the, what's the one which does it for ages, the biggest one, the polling, I always forget.
The Census Bureau? Census Bureau?
No, no, the private one, they poll all the time, the biggest poll.
Pew and...
No,
I know who you're talking
the
about.
Oldest, Gallup.
Yes.
Gallup has been polling, actually. Gallup had a great foresight. They started to poll Americans right. about happiness in 1947.
Right.
And they persevered ever since 1947. What do you think happened to American happiness lines since 1947? Absolutely flat. Right. Absolutely flat, right? And about whatever, 52%, absolutely flat.
So we're living in houses people, right? that are twice
in
as big.
In spite of basically, you know, nearly tripling the energy consumption, in spite of having 4.5-ton assault cars for 16 troops as your, you know, 7-Eleven drive things, really, right? In spite of having building, you know what's the average size? In 1950, the average size of American house was 1,250 square feet, okay? And there were very few custom-built houses. Now the average size of mass-built house in America is 2,600. An average size of custom-built house is 5,000 square feet. And there are millions of these custom-built houses built, really, right? You don't need 5,000 square foot. You know, there must be room which you never visit in that house, right? 5,000 square feet, really, right? You know, you don't need a military assault vehicle for 16 heavily armed soldiers to go for, you know, to 7-Eleven for it. We don't need these things, really. And of course, that's why we consume 360 gigajoules per capita, because we have these things, really, right?
So this gets back to on the blog, and again, the blog gets at some of the same questions you've explored as well, which is, I recently wrote a piece asking the question, do we need to outgrow growth? And this
gets
at Herman Daly, economist.
Exactly.
There's a growing body of economists who are thinking about new measurements, new ways to
Absolutely.
Measure progress. So if we just shift away from the idea that gross national product or things that grow is the norm, the expectation toward, are we doing well? Are we living decent lives? But is that doable? Can we unlearn these habits?
Well, that's the tough stuff because you see the thing, it's doable, but it's doable only by catastrophe and crisis. It's not doable voluntarily. People voluntarily will not abandon their hammers, you know, somewhere, you know, in the fields and people will not start walking to the nearest 7-Eleven. That's just the thing. It will happen because it will have to happen because of the economic squeeze or strategic squeeze or Chinese squeeze or whatever squeeze. It will happen eventually, but voluntarily, the chance of it, is very slim. Look, I tell you the secret about how to transform the world with one kind of behavior only. Maybe somebody will know. What is the thing you could do to have the biggest impact on this planet as an individual if everybody would follow you? If you do it individually, forget it. But what we could do as individuals to have the biggest impact on this planet, strategic, environmental, political, whatever. Exactly, of course, right? Exactly, right?
Not necessarily. The answer was stop eating meat.
Stop eating meat is a right answer, but it's just too extreme answer. Because genetically, evolutionarily speaking, we are omnivores, okay? Okay, we were, because to begin with, you know, we didn't have any tools. We couldn't kill the animal. Animals are, you know, nimble and, you know, ugly and fast running and ferocious. So to begin with, we were scavengers. And we scavenge whatever. If it was a sweet potato, well, we scavenge sweet potato. If it was a dead hyena, we scavenge that hyena. Yeah. So we are evolutionary absolute omnivores. We are as good as pigs. We will eat anything and everything, right? And some cuisines, like French one and Chinese one, do eat everything, right? There is nothing which is inedible in French and Chinese cuisine. Japanese come pretty close to it. Although Japanese do not like to eat kidneys and livers and brains and, you know, and these things, you know. Anyway. So we are omnivores, and given a chance, we like decent amount of meat. And of course, the modern nutritional science tells us that animal protein is the only one which is a complete one. All plant proteins are incomplete because they do not have proper ratios of amino acids. This plant is always short of cysteine. This plant is always short of lysine. You know, so either we have to care. To be a total vegetarian, it's tricky. You have to combine the proper amino acids. It's just, you know, and for children have to grow, really, right? So, you know, eggs are good, milk is good, meat is good. So let's be sensible, right? Let's not be doctrinaire vegetarians. Let's give people the amount of animal protein which make, like, you know, Japanese before they got, by 1945, when Americans came to Japan, most Japanese never saw milk, never ate cheese, right? Okay? And the kids were 10 centimeters shorter than kids everywhere. Then they institute the lunch program, bring the American milk cheese, you know, bingo, the Japanese kids are as big as American kids, right? So fine. For that, what you need is maybe like 20, 25 kilo. That's what we need, right? 20, 25 kilo of meat and maybe, like, you know, maybe a cup of milk a day. That's all. Not like in Denmark or Holland, right? You know, 10 liters per morning, right? But, you know, a cup of milk a day. Right? So, and that's all you need. So you see, if you are looking at an ideal diet, it's Japanese diet, you know, some meat, some dairy, whatever, yeah. You know, and that would reduce the consumption for apple. Let me tell them just this one figure, which is absolutely stunning, because people don't realize how what a waste of resources it is. What you see frequently quoted, how much meat costs in terms of feed, you see the wrong figures, because these are the figures which USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, publishes, and they are good, they are convenient, and they are correct, but they are on the hoof, right? So they tell you how much feed I need to produce a cow, to produce a pig. Well, I'm sorry, we don't eat a cow and pig. There's lots of hoofs and head and horns and skin on it, right? So what we call the take of weight when you kill the animal, right, and what you eat. So with cow, it could be as little as 40% what we eat. With pig is about 60%, right? With chick is about, well, this Chinese chick is everything, it's a pheasant, right? You know, beak and claws and everything, right? So when you reduce it, I've done this calculation, reducing to neat meat. When you reduce it to neat meat, because people want to eat, especially not just neat meat, but even lean meat, forget about meat with little fat. So it's like this, our best chick, which is no fun, you know, in these factories, like, crouched together so they couldn't even walk, right? But, you know, you limit their movements or lower metabolism. Yeah. We can do chick 1 to 2.5, 1 to 3, say, okay? That's it, you know? So 3 units of feed per 1 unit. Okay? Pigs, we do 1 to 6 to 1 to 7. A cattle, cow, which would be totally non-grazing, you know, just no grazing, totally in feedlot, 1 to 30, 1 to 25, right? So you need 25 units, right? And you could grow wheat instead, and people could eat directly, but you need 25 more times that land to feed that cow to get 1 kilo of beef, really, right? So beef eating particularly is totally detrimental. All beef we should do just on grazing and on crop residues, on straw and on some spoiled grain, right? So if we do that, you know, again, you know, we take ourselves from that cliff, we move closer, right? From that air hanging position.
We can scramble back to the edge.
We are going backward, right? Yeah. So this, and I'm not even, you know, I could give a lecture about the effect on emissions, because it's not only carbon dioxide through machinery to plow these fields, whatever. It's also, of course, N2O, because we heavily fertilize those fields, right, for corn, and you have the denitrification, and you have N2O rising from the fields, which is a greenhouse gas, two orders of magnitude, more greenhousey than carbon dioxide, really, right? And I'm not talking about the methane from all those cows as well. Right? So you want to reduce the global warming, be it CO2, CH4, or N2O, right? You want to reduce the land devoted to crops, let it regrow by forest or whatever, right? You know, and so on. Tremendous impact, right? Just don't eat 100 kilo of meat, eat 20, right? You have enough protein, and you'll grow as tall as Japanese kids.
In a few minutes, I'm going to turn this over to having some questions from the audience as well, and I think from the internet, from the web as well. But a couple more. I want to circle back to technology and how there's political expedience towards certain solutions that don't always make sense when you add up the numbers. And one that I quoted you on was this idea that we can have our coal and climate too if we just capture the CO2 from the carbon dioxide from a coal-burning power plant and compress it and put it back in the earth where the carbon came from. The question I'm asking is really about numbers. And you've used numbers very effectively just now in the last 20 minutes to explain problems in a clear-eyed way. But we tend to gloss over numbers so much. Take us through that little story about CO2 coming from coal and reveal why clean coal in a climate context may not be all it's touted to be.
Most happy to do so. This is a numerate audience, so calculate along with me. It's very simple, this one, right? It's very simple, okay? Let's lay the foundation first. Right now, we produce about 4 billion tons of crude oil. Okay? You'll see why it'll become important in a while. 4 billion tons of crude oil worldwide. The liquid has about, well, there are crude oils which are almost like gasoline. There are crude oils which are like tar. But say it's 0.8%, right, density, right? So 4 billion becomes close to 5 billion. So say we have 5 billion cubic meters, right? We have 4 billion tons, 5 billion cubic meters of oil. We take it out of the ground. 5 billion cubic meters.
I'm taking notes.
Okay? Now, Globally, we shove in about 8 billion tons of carbon, right? Multiply by 3.7 roughly for CO2, right? You get yourself 30 billion tons of CO2. You have 30 billion tons of CO2. Now, if you want to control it by sequestration, you cannot capture 60% of it, because 60% of it is mobile or small. You cannot capture it from the high-flying planes or from my little Honda. Right. And you will not capture it from my gas furnace. I have a super furnace in my basement, 97% efficient. But still, you know, these 3% will not be captured, right? Which go, I don't have a chimney. There's this tube at the side of the house goes out of it. So we are looking only at big sources, big stationary sources, big power plants, big refineries, big industrial plants. So maybe 40% of it is capturable, realistically, right? Yeah. 0.4 multiplied by 3. 12 billion tons of CO2 we can capture, right? Okay. Now, lots of it is in China, because that's where everything is made now. In fact, China is number one emitter right now, right? Lots of it is India, right? So these folks are not going to start capturing it next Monday. So it's the us rich folks. You would start first. So let's say we capture half of that stuff. 6 billion tons of the stationary, which we can capture, right? So we have 6 billion tons of CO2, right? That's billion tons of gas, right? Gas, right? Now, shoving it down in the ground as gas, that's kind of, you know, goes against the grain, so to speak, physically, right? So we want to liquefy it first, really, right? Of course, we can make it as heavy as water, but that would kind of cost too much energy. So we make it only as condensed when it turns into water, right? Supercritical CO2, which is just shy of 0.5 gram per cubic centimeter, right? So I have 0.5 gram per cubic centimeter. And I have 6 billion tons of CO2, so I have 12 billion cubic meters of CO2, twice the volume, right? So if I want to control half of the stationary CO2, I have to shove every year 12 billion cubic meters of it down, which is twice, more than twice the volume of global oil industry, which took 100 years plus to create, which operates in Venezuela, Siberia, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, Canada, which took some $5 trillion investment over decades to build all these pipelines, compressor stations, derrick drills. So of course we know how to do it. We know how to build a pipeline. We know how to compress the gas. You know, we know how to drill the hole and put it down the hole. We know all these things, really. But how long does it take you to create an industry shoving 12 billion cubic meters of something down, and that will be controlling what? That will be controlling 20% of the total, which means that China probably and India will make up the difference in no time and will still be emitting as much as we did ever before, right? So just tell me how rapidly you can build an industry worth several trillion dollars and shoving against the gravity 12 billion cubic meters. Now, suppose we grant all of this. Suppose, you know, a magnificent outside force shoves it down for us, costs us nothing. Well, you know, the thing which we get out, these 5 billion cubic meters of oil which we get out, somebody's willing to pay, as of last Friday, $78 per barrel. Somebody's willing to pay. Who is willing to pay for this? Right. We would have to be taxed, heavily taxed for everything we buy, right, to put it down there, right? And then, that's not the end of the story, you know? So 12 billion cubic meters, you know, that's then paying for it. But suppose somebody even pays for it. Somebody shoves it for us and pays for it. You are the ones who want to be living next to the storage advertised, the biggest CO2 storage on planet, 5 billion cubic meters stored right under your feet. Somebody will have to live next door to this. You see how people are eager to live to any power plant, to any refinery, to any giant wind farm, right? So where are the takers willing to live next to 1 or 2 billion? Because it's a gas, right? And eventually it will start creaking and squeaking through the crevices and coming out, right? Gas heavier than air. So you go with your dog for a walk one day and your dog will not survive the walk, really, right? You know? And as simple as that, really. So who will be guaranteeing that these reservoirs will never leak, really?
Right.
So what will have to happen, like with nuclear, Anderson Act, government has to step in and say, you know, we will have to pay it eventually when these reservoirs will start leaking and, you know, whatever. So the legal issues, when you forget about economic issues, when you forget about technical issues, shoving 12 billion cubic meters down the ground every year, which is 1 trillion cubic meters, right? It's mind-boggling, these things, right?
So that whole clean coal mantra in the climate
context. And you
see,
this all could be done in whatever, right? In that calculation itself, if I wouldn't have talked around it, the calculation itself takes five seconds, really, right? Compare it to that oil business, right? You know, so of course it's doable. People always say, but it's doable. We know how to build pipeline and pump gas and compress. Of course we know, really, right? You know, but think about the volumes, really, right? You know, doubling the global oil industry in what, right?
Yeah. Right? So if that seems pretty clearly off the list. But it, boy, is
no,
it getting...
it's not off the list because oil industry knows how to do it.
Right.
And governments are eager to show they are doing something, so it will be done.
And but, the coal, no. And by the way, yeah. The coal yeah, companies
so everybody
have a lot
loves
of power.
It basically right. Because, you know, and it's something which we can do today, right? So it will right. Be done. But given the fact that we are pumping 30 billion, yeah. And what is the size of these things, like, you know, in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, in Saleh, in Algeria, and Sleipner in North Sea, like, you know, they are measured in millions of tons, right? You know, per year, right? Millions of tons, right? Yeah. Here we have to store, you know, many billions of tons. And forever, basically, not forever, but, you know, precisely when it would happen, then we would say, well, we can exhaust our coal resources, right? Because we are hiding it now, right? Yeah. So we could be then stuck with this for next 200 years, right? Yeah. Or 150 years, right? Yeah. Not a wise thing to do.
So let's go to photovoltaics or things like that. There's been this sense, a lot of, an aura of, well, we're doing it now, venture capital is flowing, and photovoltaic cells, all we have to do is manufacture them at a bigger scale, and they'll get cheap enough that they'll just spread magically. There, too, without a lot of innovation, it sounds like having that actually have any meaning to the atmosphere, let's say, in long term, is pretty dubious.
Well, you know, the photovoltaics, I love photovoltaics. This is the, because it has the, you know, those of you know what I'm talking about, this is the highest power density of all renewable resources. That is watts per square meter, right?
Of the sun,
you know,
just
of the, because
down
it's coming,
over.
So yeah. Even if you catch, you know, the globally average is 170 watts per square meter, and that's average day and night for the whole globe, really, right? In the sunny afternoon, of course, you get 1,000 watts per square meter, right, at 1 p.m., really. So if you capture 30% of it, well, you could have something, you know, 300 watts flowing per square meter. But we don't really, you know, because you have to say, you have to take it globally when you take in long run, you know, you have to think about global mean, and that's 170 watts, yeah. Really, right? And of it, we capture now reliably, we capture 10%, 15% at best, really. So our cells are no more than about 20, 30 watts per square meter, really, right? So just calculate your house, and especially, you know, when I started the calculation for Winnipeg winter, right, you know, and I have a small house, so I don't have a giant roof, and I don't want to plaster my backyard with photovoltaic cells, really, right? And then you have these things, really, right? It's true, you know, that when it's very cold, right, then there's a high pressure cell and there is no wind. This is why the windy place, you know, North Dakota, Manitoba, they are extremely windy places. People say, we put all these wind turbines there, really, right? Except when it's very cold and it's minus 40, well, then there is no wind. That's precisely because it's minus 40, really. So I can kiss my wind generators by, right? So then it's very sunny and my photovoltaic is working fine. But then there are these windy days, especially in this part of Canada, where you may not see sun for 3 weeks, really, right? So what do you do with these things when you need it, really? So both wind and solar runs against tremendous environmental constraint in high latitude temperate climates, 40, 45, 50 degrees north, really. It's not trivial, really, right?
So my needle is still ticking over toward the downside here, toward the Wile E. Coyote types, because the world is heading roughly toward 9 billion. Maybe we'll luck out and it'd be 8 or something. And even if we come out at, let's say we all live a Japanese life, half as intense.
Even
as
that is too much. Japanese life is still too much.
And even if you discount global warming, we don't have the energy choices we need. So are you saying we're going to hit an energy wall, essentially, that will take us back to that new norm?
Yes, again, because we have options. We have tremendous options. You can start doing these very simple calculations, and they are extremely powerful, these simple calculations. Because let's look at this continent, same for US and Canada. Half of the vehicles on the road are not cars anymore. Half of the vehicles which people use as cars are SUVs, pickup trucks, and vans, right? Which were not there 30 years ago. 30 years ago, people had cars, right? Now people, so half of the, now, you know, we had this corporate automobile fuel efficiency, right? Which improved, which doubled between 73 and 87 or 85, from 13 to 27, and it was stuck. Until now, it's stuck at 27, right? But this would be, so average vehicle in US and Canada would be 27.5 miles per gallon. But because half of them are not cars, actually the average for the American, North American fleet is only 22 miles per gallon, right?
Yeah.
Right now, I'll tell you. If people would just, I have to say, I say it again, this is my mission in life, the Honda solution. If people would just drive Honda Civic, it's 48. So we would more than double the efficiency. We would cut down the oil consumption by half. Imagine if the single biggest chunk, US consumes 60% of its oil, the biggest chunk of it is to make that gasoline, really, right? 40% is for the gasoline. Imagine if that would go down by half. In the first place, Canada would be in the poorhouse because we would have no oil to sell to Americans, because we are number one exporter of oil to US, right? You know. So, and number two, the oil prices would collapse because the biggest importer, importing 60% of its oil, would suddenly need about half as much, right?
Yeah.
As simple. Is it so unbearable to drive Honda Civic? Is it so unbearable? And you can, you know, you can refashion. That's even better than eating 20 kilo of meat, because cars last about 9 years, right? So as they, you know, retire, you just simply start buying Honda Civics. And by the end of the 9th year, the US has averaged 45 mpg.
Yeah.
Okay? Just like that, really. Just like that, right? And you still can drive the same number of cars, two cars per family, whatever, right? You know, but it'll be 45 instead of 32, right? So, you know, we are so wasteful at the same time that there is always hope for us that we'll kind of become a quarter smart or 10% smart and choose some of these semi-rational solutions, really, right?
You, when you were talking about Japan before, being an island nation with such limited land
yeah.
constraints, and how that shapes their sort of conservation ethic with things. That reminded me of this longstanding vision I've been writing about on the blog off and on, of reminding us of that old, it was a quaint notion in the 60s, well, really, we live on this tiny planet. Our planet is an island in the great cosmos, the quantum to cosmos. And if we only were reminded of that reality, then we'd all basically potentially start living that more constrained
But it never
life.
Happens voluntarily. As I say, it never happens voluntarily. We have to be we have to be forced, pushed. The fact, let's say, you know, the Japan is the biggest importer of food on this planet. Most people don't know it. So, you know, they have to be more frugal with their food because they import most of it, right?
Yeah.
They import 100% of their energy, except for their nuclear, but they import the fuel for those nuclear power plants as well. So only hydroelectricity is domestic. Otherwise, they import everything. Right? So in Japan, you import everything. So you are kind of, you know, more frugal with these things, right? So except so people have to be killed, you know, they have to be hit at their pockets. If they are not hit at their pockets, they will not do it voluntarily, no doubt.
So it's not just a function of putting that Earth image up on
computer
screens.
You know, people wrote books about it, right? The blue dot transformatory image. Once people see the planet from afar, you know, they will start behaving. Well, it was since that time we got our SUVs and, you know, condo shares in Hawaii and everything, right? So it was after the blue dot, not before the blue dot. And before the blue dot, Las Vegas was a sleepy mafia town in Nevada. Now it's the single fastest growing metropolitan area on this planet, or at least in North America, really, right? So that was all after the blue dot, really, right? You know, imagine building a fastest growing metropolitan area in the middle of desert on water, which has been already over-allocated decades ago, okay? Right? You know, it's mind-boggling, right? So there is a hope for us, you know, but not much hope for Las Vegas, right? Right?
So if I were charting out this path you've kind of laid out, again, here we are, 1 billion people, here we are, 9 billion, well, 6.7 heading toward 9. I don't get the sense that you're drawing a smooth curve.
No, there is nothing smooth.
There's a
collapses are
a
inevitable.
Lot of jiggles.
Collapses are inevitable, and collapses are happening already, you know. I mean, Alice in Wonderland, how the US can afford to pay for additional $2 trillion incurred every 6 months? I mean, you know, this cannot end well simply, right? I mean, these others, you don't have to take a single kindergarten course in economics. This cannot. That's just, and you know, it's
Is this one reason you live in Manitoba?
Pleasant place to live, you know. We have the cheapest hydroelectricity on the planet, you know, Nelson River flows over the turbine. There's no pollution. As the wind blows, the closest chimney to us is Norilsk in Siberia. If you get go straight northwest, you know, so that's the closest chimney to us. Very clean air, you know, beautiful environment, you know, cold winter, you can ski on the river. Oh, it's just a beautiful place. Yesterday, the drive on that 401 from Pearson Airport, I would shoot myself in my head after a day, obviously. Just, you know, just, I don't understand why you people live here. I mean, this is just, you know, this is just, you know, you must be a different species, totally, you know. You've been selected for this self-torture, you know, of high level, right, you know.
Do you have a vision? I've talked to some people at places like the IASA, that International Institute for Advanced Studies, who do really long-term projections for human population. And they're not saying this is what will happen.
Yeah.
They're just like thought experiments. And there was one model run by Wolfgang Lutz
that shows
we're at around the year 2200, there'll probably be 3 billion people on the planet. Do you have your own, do you have a vision in your head of this sort of, the end of the 21st century, what the world will look like? Could look like.
No.
I know you don't do forecasts, so this is not a forecast.
No,
but,
I don't. You see, I don't at all. I totally want to abstain from this, and I tell you why. Let me give you another set of delicious examples, right? 2100, heavens, you know, 91 years. Why don't we go to something as recent as we can? Say 1985 even, right? Who the hell in 1985 would have forecast total peaceful collapse of the USSR, which came just 6 years later, right? In 1985, that was 5 years after the beginning of reforms in China, but China was still a dinky place doing nothing, really. US had a huge trade surplus with China in 1985. They were buying all these Boeings and whatever, right? Who the hell would forecast in 1985 that 90% or 85% of crap in Walmart would be made in China, right? No, who would have forecast in 1985 that the future of Western civilization will be hanging on men who swore to kill us because we are infidels from the case of Afghanistan? Who would have, you know, in 1985, really? So what's the point of making these forecasts to do something? The three things we changed the world since 1895, the rise of Muslim fundamentalism, the rise of China, and collapse of the USSR, were totally unpredictable and unpredicted by anybody a few years before they happened, right? Yeah. And they move everything. They move the emissions of CO2. Imagine how much CO2 would we have saved if China would have remained impoverished Maoist economy, right? You know, instead of the factory for the world, right? On the other hand, imagine how much more CO2 we would have put into the atmosphere if the USSR would have continued to build the biggest military on the planet for another 20 years, right? Right? And imagine what, you know how much 9/11 has cost us so far? I'm working on these new estimates now. It has cost us so far probably at least $2 or $3 trillion, and the clock is ticking, right? This Afghan war, this is the longest war the US have been engaged in, right? The cost of Afghan war probably will reach $2 trillion alone in the next 10 years, right? You know, so this is what 9/11 cost us, trillions and trillions of dollars, right? US had, as I said, was a creditor nation in 1985, right? Now, there is no hope that it will become ever anything but the biggest debtor on this planet, right?
So, unless something completely unexpected something, happens.
Exactly, precisely. That's the thing, right? But you see, do you see anything happening on the upside, so to speak, in the 15 years for the US? Do you think that, you know, the Muslim fundamentalists will say suddenly, you know, no problem, Taliban will come to you know, the White House and say, you know, oh, just give us a school for little girls, right? Do you see that happening, right? I don't see that happening. Right?
Now we're going to turn it over to the audience to ask some questions. Not because I've run out, but I want to have your input here as well. There are some microphones that will be in the front here. So if you have a question, come down. And while you're doing that, I'm going to ask one more. Paul Ehrlich, who is definitely one of the wall people, you know, the Wile E. Coyote people, he is part of an initiative right now to start what they call a Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior. Yeah. MOB. MAHB, and this gets at this underlying question again. If you could reach into our genetic history and tweak one trait that might make a difference, would you? Could you
define that? It's very easy. This is one trait which made us human above all. You know, bipedality, toleration of thirst, hunting the antelope for 6 hours without drinking, things like that. But the most important one is this: we are infinitely adaptable. We are infinitely adaptable. You know? Let's say the country of which I know so much, Japan. Japanese standard of living in 1946. There was nothing there. There was nothing there. People were literally, or South Korea in 1955, one rubble field, right? Because the armies came one way, one way, one way, plowed over threefold, right, by the Chinese. And now it's the world, 13th largest economy in the world, right? We can adapt to bad or good, anything, but you know, we have to be forced into it. We don't do these things voluntarily, right? You know, we adapt only when we have to adapt. This is our problem. So no other animal on this planet has ever been so adaptable as we are. As you know, the only thing which we can't do is to fly on our own. Otherwise, you know, we're just totally mad.
Is this an upside thing or a downside thing?
It's both upside and downside, really. So it could be an upside if you need to be saved from bad things. You know, you can go. You know, we can live, and again, on 1,700 kilocalories of cornmeal, if need be, really, right? You know, and we've done it many times before, really, right? You know, that's the thing. So both hope and but. As I say, you know, it doesn't happen voluntarily. We have to be pushed into it by circumstances, whatever they are, right? Wars, famines. Economic crisis, right?
That's the other category of risk I have that I explore on the blog. There's slow drips and there's hard knocks.
Yeah, hard
and
knocks.
Usually it's slow hard drip knocks. And then hard knock. Yeah, but so it will take, partially because of our constitution.
And we are smart, so we see these small things coming and we see the trend, it's going, mm-hmm. but we are unwilling to act unless really it's a bit too late or unless it's inevitable to act, really, right? So not that we are bad at recognizing the trends. We see them. You have to be stupid not to see many of these trends, right? But we are unwilling to act on them because it's easier not to act than to act. Because to act is always some sort of sacrifice. And we are not willing to take that voluntary sacrifice.
Yeah, I remember last year, let's put it this way. 2 weeks before the financial collapse, I was at a meeting and a young man stood up who studies markets. And he said, he gave the best argument I'd ever heard for why the economy was about to tank. Yeah. And I called my wife. I was impressed enough that I called my wife from this meeting. I said, should we move our retirement stuff out of stocks? But guess what? We did not.
She
of
said,
course.
No, of course.
No, she didn't. I just didn't bother doing it. Exactly. It was one of, you know, inertia set in. And again, this is another one of these.
No, inertia and humanity. So again, adaptability is immense, but inertia is probably no less immense than that, really. It's just the thing, you know, it requires some jolt from the outside. It rarely comes from inside. You know, some people claim to have this insight and they turn and they become Buddhists, but that doesn't work, you know, very well either. Really. They have all their cell phones, these Buddhist monks these days as well. So it just doesn't work, really.
Now, is it true that they have no desire? Yeah. That's what I would like to know, really, Dan. Are there any questions out there? If not, I'd always have more. Is your mic on? Put it close to your mouth just to test it. I think it might be okay. No? Okay. Oh, there we go.
Podium on? Yes. Okay, so I have question one from Marnie from Toronto. This is our online questioner. You can cut back, she says, but with finite resources, you solve nothing. You just slow down the time it takes to hit the wall. Without innovation, we are heading to the same fate. So where is the best place to invest our time and money to ensure explosive innovation?
Well, you see, it's a time question, right? People always claim these things that you have to do innovation full tilt because whatever, more, I don't like the term is conservation or whatever, more rational use. People say more rational use of resources will not get us anywhere, that's what he says. That's a standard argument. Well, you know, not quite really, because it's a matter of time. These things are unfolding really, right? So they give us time in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. Don't tell me it wouldn't make a difference. Suppose you subscribe to the standard IPCC theory, right? The warming is severe and it's coming clearly, right? And it's worsening. So wouldn't things be better if we would be EV in the Western world, right? We'd be consuming half as many resources. If let's say North America would be like France, or if France would try to be like whatever, like South, right. You know, wouldn't make a difference in the next 30 years? Of course it would really, right? You know, so I'm not saying, of course, it's quite obvious, right? If you have another 2 billion people, and if everybody of these, eventually sub-Saharan Africa, everybody wants to reach the standard of maybe even just South Korea or whatever, well, of course, you know, so it's not enough really, right? But it's the best and fastest things we can do. We cannot suck out massive innovation, some super cheap, super solar you mentioned out of our thumb for next Monday, right? But we all can start driving Hondas tomorrow almost, right? Yeah. We all can start eating less meat. We all don't have to build 5,000 square foot houses, right? It's a tremendous, especially if you think that 5% of us consume 25 to 30% of what's there. Really. So it certainly does make difference in short run, right? Short run being 10, 20, 30 years, right? It's not the ultimate solution, but it makes difference, right?
Yeah. But there's still, well, we'll see how this all plays out. It's such a, as a journalist, you see, I get the luxury of sitting on the sidelines and just writing about all these things. And I am trying to experiment a little bit more with using the web. Will the ability to move information where it's needed seamlessly and instantaneously, does that provide some prospect for speeding things? Sub-Saharan Africa is getting mobile phone technology at a pace that we, it took us 100 years to build our wired telecom.
Let me give you one example. But when I think something, you know, as I say, it's impossible to forecast these things because you know we didn't anticipate in 1985 these things I outlined. But thinking as a biologist, what might happen? Imagine, you know, we would get, and we've been trying to get it for some time, but no success. Imagine that 30 years from now, with all this new genetic manipulation, we would get self-fertilizing plants. That is, we would basically have wheat, which behaves as soybean, making its own nitrogen, right? And imagine, you know, we would get even eventually plant which is using this scarce phosphate much more efficiently, right? So if we do that, oh, that's a big difference. We wouldn't have to make any nitrogen fertilizers. We wouldn't have to fertilize our field. We wouldn't need these tractors to run over it and whatever, right? You know, and we would basically be producing food, you know. Plus, of course, eventually you can have a plant which hardly needs any water because some plants have a much higher water use efficiency than others. So this genetic manipulation eventually to get us to super crops which grow in arid land, which self-produce nitrogen, are much more efficient than picking up the soil phosphate, right? Yeah. And are much more efficient to withstand any grasshopper willing to nibble on it. This is within the realm of possible, right? We can design, because there are individual crops which have all of these qualities, right? Some crows which grasshoppers will not eat, some crows will
not eat. Are we doing enough of that kind of work?
No, we are not going, and it's not an easy thing because it doesn't reside in a single gene. It's not like, you know, you bring a gene like, you know, with glyphosate for, you know, for the genetically modified soybeans. Basically, it's a very simple thing. This is, you have to change the whole plant, really, or make it many plants together, whatever. But this is not impossible. So this may, so while we become more frugal and more rational over the next 20, 30 years, you know, this buys us some time, and then we get these super plants. And that will be a huge, huge difference, right? And then maybe in 40 years, we get a solar cell, which will be 50% efficient, right?
Do you feel, you teach at a university along with your writing and everything, do you feel that we're doing enough to shape the way we teach the next generation to be A, numerate, look at problems with that kind of unglossed, clarity, and to then pursue
You shouldn't have asked me this question. My view on this is, my view on this is as dim as the dimmest non-existent star. it's just this.
Which one?
This, despite all these gizmos and all this information, this is the most enumerate and most scientifically literate generation in human history. Okay. I don't have any, you know, I mean, I come from the city which was, you know, Pilsen in Czech Republic, you know, the biggest engineering works in continental Europe. 14-year-old kids knew how to take apart a motorcycle and put it together back, really. You know, there was this technical literacy in young people, you know, and people can do, when you do these things, you know, they could read a blueprint, they could, you know, they could calculate in their head simple things, right? You know, yesterday I was watching CNN. I came to this beautiful isolated strip mall place, this Jacobs Inn there, and I switched on the CNN, and there is this guy saying, imagine $1.4 trillion US deficit, and behind him is $1.4 billion. Okay? They don't even know how to put the right order of magnitude in CNN. They broadcast to the whole planet. This is the most enumerate civilization on planet. Most of my students cannot. If I tell them, what is 15% out of 85? They could never hack that one without calculator. They could never hack that one, right? As simple as that, right? And you see, please don't ask people, you know, what is heavier, if the uranium or water is heavier, right? Or anything like, don't ask people, you know, what is the density of sand? What is the density of topsoil, right? When you work with topsoil. People don't know the basic thing because people don't work with their hands anymore. People don't disassemble machines, most of them don't. People don't have the, from the ground up knowledge. Really. They know how to communicate with extraterrestrials. They know that, really, right? You know, but if you would ask them, you know, what are the steps in making dough, right? You know, most people think pizza comes from Pizza House or whatever. Most people never make a dough, really. I'm not going to ask how many people know how to do a real good dough.
It sounds like, if I really step way back and look at this whole scenario you've laid out, it's maybe we need to embrace the coming collapse as our kind of route to more connectedness, more...
Yes, connectedness, that's the word, you know. I see most of my students are utterly unconnected. They're connected this way, they're constantly jabbering. But they say, what was the last time you look at the sky, right? You know, what is the most common kind of cloud in Manitoba this time of the year, right? You know, they wouldn't know because they don't know these clouds, right? You know? And I ask them, well, let's say I lecture and there is a window, right? And I say, what is the species of the tree out there, right? Huh? You know, they don't know. If it's a choke cherry or if it's a, you know, Manitoba maple or if it's an Amur maple, they have no idea. They have no name for trees. They have no name for birds. They have no names for anything, right? They just jabber on the cell phones, right?
Here comes a member of a generation younger than you or I.
Hi. It seems to me that you're saying that something that we could call a collapse is inevitable because people won't change their behavior until they're forced to by a change in circumstances. But often when people talk about collapse, they imagine something much more unsettling. People imagine people changing their behavior by, for instance, electing fascist or communist governments or otherwise behaving disastrously. What do you see as determining the difference between people responding to forced change in a positive way, which will adapt them both individually and collectively, and adapting to forced change in a negative way by making the problems worse, either with a lot of policies we see today, airport security, or with a lot of policies that we've seen in the past, the Weimar Republic?
Well, in the first place, you shouldn't imagine that collapse like that coyote collapse. You know, the whole system is a coyote and collapses. Really. Yeah. We are constantly collapsing in many ways, but we are constantly jerking ourselves back on that cliff again, right? So it's just the thing. That's a wrong, you know, this is a wrong analogy here. So sometimes we act. Look, let's say the best thing, still the classic thing, look at the Antarctic ozone. We acted very rapidly, right? Mm. and we quote-unquote heal the whole, really. By 2025, right, or something like that, it's like if it's never happened, really, right? Because we acted very rapidly, right? So, you know, we learned, and we thought potentially this is a very serious thing because you don't want to lose the ozone shield for the planet, right? So, you know, sometimes we do act very rapidly and very sensibly. Ah, but you look closer, so you say, oh, this is a great hope, right? We dealt with stratospheric ozone so actively, so, but you look closer and you see why it was so easy. Well, you know, because only two big companies in the world, ICI and DuPont, were making 90% of the stuff, and they made more money by making the substitute, right? And it required only what? Agreement of a bunch of nations, because right. Malawi and Zimbabwe and Sri Lanka were not making the stuff, really. Right. So it was an easy solution. But CO2, everybody's burning fossil fuel. Everybody's deforesting. Everybody's burning wood, really, right? So you need an agreement of 180 nations, right? And it's billions of tons, it's not millions of tons. So, right. you know, this is a good example, but it's a bad example as well. Really. So you cannot take the example of stratospheric ozone and say, we acted, you know, with foresight and rapidly or whatever, right? So, and sometimes we, I don't know if there are many examples that that once we learn that something is really bad, that we persevere doing it even worse and worse. Right? We may do it, you know, for a while, but eventually, you know, we wake up and, sometimes it's very difficult. Like when you look at this CO2 thing, look, Chinese have been saying it for past 20 years and they are not going to change their tune. They say, and I don't know if you are aware of this, they say not only, okay, they say, we may be number one emitter ahead of the US now, but in per capita terms, we are only a small fraction of what US is, number one. Number two, in per capita terms, extended back to 1810 or 1780 when US started to mine its coal and, you know, Pittsburgh furnace is 1870, whatever. So only when we reach the per capita cumulative level of you folks over past 200 years of burning fossil fuels, then come and ask us. Then it's equitable and moral to ask us to throttle down, really, which means like what, 2150 or whatever, right? You know? So I just don't see any Copenhagen meeting coming in December. Well, Chinese will just come and say the same thing as they're always saying, right? You know, Chinese say per capita plus 200 years, basically, really, right? You know, so this is not an ozone layer problem, right? And what kind of appetite in US is to impose massive carbon taxes on a country with 18% unemployment now?
Right.
Right.
So when I was in college, I read a lot of books by René Dubos, who wrote a column for a while. He used to write about the human altered environment as not such a terrible thing, that you can actually live in the environment and as a human, as part of the environment and do okay. And he used to call himself a despairing optimist. So if you had to label yourself.
Yeah, I agree absolutely, because despairing in the sense that, you know, we have such capacity to be so much more rational and to do sensible things. 1001, you know, from driving Honda to eating less meat, right? From not trying to inculcate into Chinese that it's good to be Americans. We are just helping them to do it, right? Every American company is there, you know? I mean, the country is building a bigger system of interstate freeways and already is the third world's largest importer of oil. Soon it will surpass Japan and it will be number two importer of oil, really. And they are building six-lane freeways everywhere. So we are doing stupid things and then we wonder we get, you know, bad results. So yes, despairing optimists. We have capacity to, you know, to be much, 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 much better off, right? But we don't show any gumption, any will to act on this capacity.
If there are no more questions out there, I'll ask you one more, which is if you had a message for the, again, the young people, the next generation coming along. On my blog, I call them Generation E. They're a potential generation. People focused on not just environment, that's too simple, or energy, that's too simple, but equity, education. What would you say to someone just coming out, emerging now as a learner and then
Oh, it's very simple. I mean, beautiful question. This is the best question of the whole talk. Very simple. Read anything possible. Read anything possible. Read Zola. Read Baudelaire. Read Hemingway, don't read any science. Okay, read science as well, you know, but read just the beautiful books, you know. I mean, reading Zola, last year I finished whole Zola. I read everything Zola ever wrote,
wow.
Which some of you who know what Zola wrote, this is not a mean task, right? You know, it's a lifetime ever. This is about, but read stuff people don't read. Everything which we know, everything which you know and I know, comes from reading. Okay, maybe 3% comes from talking to somebody else, but 97% come from reading, really, right? So without reading, there is no civilization. Without reading, there is no sapient humanity. It's everything, right? And we've lost that, right? People communicate with these devices now, right? Instead of reading, right? These devices contain like three sentences in in abbreviated, illiterate English, really, right? You know, without reading, you can never, you know, are they sending messages saying inconspicuous, right? Fragile, right? Friable, right? You know, I mean, no, you know, you have to read. If you read, you speak a decent language, and you understand human behavior, and you become a human. That's what made us superhuman, reading, as simple as that.
Sounds good to me. Well, thank you very much for your time.
This has been great.